The pastors were speaking this week. It's not unusual, we speak to each other every week, but this week we commented on how timely it is that we are beginning this six-week series on Job. But then I thought a little bit more about it, and because of the nature of this material, any week that we chose to begin a six-week series on Job would be timely. I'm not going to do all 6 weeks in one, I promise. I've been pretty good across the morning. But I'm going to give you some general background, and we're going to look at some themes in the book, specifically what the theme today seems to be about, and then get into some application. Job is the oldest book in the Bible. And you might say, Pastor, how do you know that? Because really, really smart biblical scholars have determined that Job is the oldest book in the Bible. And the way they did that is by the language that's used in it. So, for example, if I were to have for you on, you know, up on the wall there, some Shakespearean English, and then English from today's paper side by side, there's not a one of you who would not be able to identify which is the older English. And that's true with languages everywhere. They develop. And so the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the predominant language of the Old Testament, is older in Job than in any other book. They think somewhere 1500 BC or even older. Another thing that's very important to grasp when we're looking at Job as a whole is it is a parable. It's a long parable, 42 chapters long, but it's a parable. And you might say, I don't know, Pastor, you know, I'm a little unsettled by that. Well, there are 66 books in the Bible and multiple genres. There's poetry in there. There is history in there. But there are also parables and allegories and metaphors and all kinds of things. And this book begins in the same way that parables do. There was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. No archaeologist has ever been able to identify where Uz is. There's no record of it anywhere else. There was once a man. Where else do we hear that language? Where do you hear this language? A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. You know what parable that begins? The Good Samaritan. There was a man who had two sons. We call that the prodigal son. So no one would say, well, the Good Samaritan is not true. Jesus presented it as a parable because it is universally true. No one would say the prodigal son is not true. Jesus presented it as a parable because it is universally true. And so also we'll find Job to be universally true. It's more true than many things that happen in history only once. Job is often characterized as being a treatment on suffering. And that would be fair, but it's more than that. We'll talk about that in a moment. We've titled the sermon this morning, Undeserved Suffering, and we know it's a little bit of a provocative title because it presumes some continuum of correlation between suffering and whether or not one has earned it. And that correlation usually has something to do with are there things that I've done, choices that I've made that have somehow caused or brought about this suffering? And on the one end of the continuum, you would have total innocence. You had nothing whatsoever to do with what came your way. And on the other would be, you know, what you're suffering is the direct result of things that you have brought on yourself. And we can all come up with examples that fit, you know, one or both of those extremes. But see it as a continuum, not an either or. Usually it has to do with behavioral things. So an example of the latter would be anyone who grew up after the time when the Surgeon General started putting warning packets on cigarettes saying, hey, these things are bad for you. Would not be in a position to say, how is it that I contracted lung cancer? However, having been with people who have been dying of end-stage lung cancer and seen how awful that ending is. I don't know that any one of us would have such a cold, cold heart as to say, you're getting what you deserve. Too bad. So in some way, all suffering is undeserved. But I think also we've seen enough where what one receives has nothing whatsoever to do with who they are or what they did. And Job is clearly presented in this parable as being like that. He's upright. He does everything right. Everything. So we might say that Job is primarily about suffering, and not only suffering, but about reflection on it. That's going to play out more in the weeks to come. We try and understand, why is this? Why is this happening? How is this happening to me? But others have said Job is really about the sovereignty of God. Who are we to question God's godness? Others would say Job is about randomness. There's no connection between what happens and what we do. And others would say Job is primarily about, or at least additionally, about faith. How is it that Job remains faithful in the face of what comes his way? And in fact, I think that is the primary theme of these first two chapters. I know I just read chapter one, but chapter two, it just gets worse for Job. Just gets worse. You can read it tomorrow. But in chapter two, he loses almost everything else. I mean, his health declines. The only thing he's still left with is his wife, and she doesn't really help him either. She says, why are you still faithful? Just curse God and die already. It's in there. It's in verse or chapter two. So how is it that this happens? How is it brought about? Well, you heard me use a term as I was reading this, the accuser. And the Hebrew in that is the Satan. Some of your Bibles might say Satan with a capital S. But much theology develops across the Bible. And this is one of them. In the Old Testament, you don't get Satan as a person. You get the accuser very few places. And you might say, well, Pastor, what about the garden? You know, well, that was a serpent. Read your Genesis. That was a serpent. Granted, a serpent who talked and who clearly tempted. But the identification is not in the Old Testament. It's only when you get to the New. And there, this role, this function, this description gets a name and takes on much more potency and prominence. So the accuser comes to God, seems to be part of the heavenly conversation at least, and says, you know, the only reason that Job is so faithful to you is because his life's great. He's got some kind of a quid pro quo thing going. And all it would take would be for that to go away. And you'd see what Job is really made out of. In fact, I think he would curse you to your face. God says, all right, you can see why parable is important here. If this is a historical description of how God acts, we'd think, yeah, that's a pretty high-stakes game to be playing. The only boundary is that Job's life itself is to be spared. So what happens when he loses everything? Does he curse God to his face? He does not. Does he remain faithful? He does. However, Job gets conversational with God. He does question. And he does cry out. So I'd mentioned earlier that we could have chosen any week in the year to begin a series on Job and found it relevant. Because you don't have to look too far to find suffering. You don't, if you live long enough, you don't have to look at all for suffering to find its way to you. It just does. You don't have to look too far to find what we would call undeserved suffering. You don't have to look too far to find, as we will see, you know, looking at these upcoming weeks, attempts to explain or understand the root of suffering. You don't have to look too far to find that those explanations always, always, always fail to satisfy, fail to comfort, and fail to bring life. And you also don't have to look too far to find the accuser at work in anything that would pull us away from God or apart from each other. I mean, that's really what the accuser is up to with this whole play. Wants to see, can I pull Job away from God? And suffering today seems to have that same potential to pull us apart, away from God, and apart from each other. I grew up during the Vietnam War. I experienced, watched on TV, the Watergate hearings, all of that. I remember the Cold War very well. 9/11. Here's something sobering. Young people born today are farther away from the events of 9/11 than I was from the end of World War II when I was born. I feel older just saying that. You know, but I mean, do that sometime. You know, look at things that seem to you to be far away or close, and you realize how much of life you've experienced. I remember the first Iraq War, Persian Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. I remember, you know, and of course on the other side of 9/11, I remember the second, and also Afghanistan, many, many things. Point is, these things have been highly divisive, have served to pull us apart from each other. But I also lived during much of the space exploration. I remember John Glenn being a national hero. I remember, you know, the Gemini program, Apollo. We came home to watch Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. And I watched the space shuttle land on the ground. I've seen technology expand in ways unimaginable. Education be extended to more of the population than ever before. Healthcare the same way. And I understand not everybody benefits the same way from those things. General standard of living rising at an unprecedented level. God bless you. Those things have had the effect of uniting us. So here's my question for the day. What unites us today? Hard to say, isn't it? It might be fear. It might be. What pulls us apart today? What would separate us from each other and also from God? You might be thinking, Pastor, just open the paper and read. You know, we've got a list. Pick one. Pick 10. It is a time in which we are pulling apart. I want to stay with the theme and with our content from Job. And so let's look at suffering. How does suffering pull us apart? How does undeserved suffering threaten to pull us apart? It was a very, very bad week for law enforcement in our country. We've had others. It was not isolated. But the breadth and depth of suffering around law enforcement this week, pretty grim. Two younger adult black males either being questioned or brought into custody by police, were shot in the act. Captured on video for anyone who's got the stomach for that. And at least in part in response to that, there were targeted shootings of police officers, at least in Dallas, intentionally white police officers. If you got all the way to page 4 the other day, you found that there were at least 3 other targeted attacks on police officers. No one would say, well, I'm thinking no one in this room would say, that those black men deserved to die. Likewise, no one would say that those police officers deserved to die. And so, of course, the commentary has been widely varied. I mean, we live in a country where speech is not checked. And some of the commentary has been helpful and some of it less so. Personally, I like what Representative Ryan had to say to the House the other day. Let us not let our anger deepen the divisions among us. Let's not go even deeper into our corners, even farther into our corners. I think it's important because while he doesn't use the language of how the accuser works, he understands the power of words to pull us apart. And that's the dynamic that is at work in our reading today. And if you're not sure about that, it's just all you have, just read and listen. It's not even possible for in our desire to explain, it's not even possible to lift up the value of some lives without others chiming in and saying, well, then that devalues these lives. And can you see how that works? I mean, as soon as you're in that conversation, the accuser is accomplishing the mission. Humanity is pulling apart. How do you know when you're in one of these places? It's blame or it's excusing. And I hope you can see that blame and excusing are two sides of the same coin. And both of them have the effect of pulling us apart. The accuser can only destroy. There is no life on that path. And if you find yourself inclined to go there, you're gonna feel it. You're gonna feel yourself moving away from another person or another group of people or in the conversation or whatever. So what does Job have to say to us here? Lots, I believe. First of all, Job's friends, as we're going to see in the weeks that play out, when they come to him immediately after his suffering, they sit silently with him. They don't say a word. They're overwhelmed by the magnitude, the depth of what he's experienced. They wouldn't presume to explain or to blame. And Job is comforted by their presence. If you've ever had really, really hard loss in your life, you know what it's like to have someone come alongside and just be with you. Something about the weight spreading to just one more person is life-giving. We're going to find Job's friends should have quit while they were ahead, because then they just can't stay quiet. And they seek to explain, which has, you're going to find, excusing and blaming attached to it. And there's just no life in that. So that's not helpful for us either. You are also going to hear that Job does reach out and cry out to God. And that is as helpful and as right-minded as ever now. Dallas and numerous other major cities have had powerful gatherings of people to stand before God and realize the limits of our human attempts to get these things right. Cycles of retribution lead only to more death and destruction. So you've seen the photos, black, white, law enforcement, citizens gathered together, humbled before God in prayer. One more question for you. Can you think of another person in the Bible who suffers undeservedly and even who questions God and who cries out to God? Can you think of another person in the Bible of whom that's true? Pretend this is a children's sermon. What's the answer always to the... Yeah, I mean, can you... I mean, in so many ways, Job prefigures Jesus. I mean, it breaks down. Eventually, everything does. But in so many ways, he prefigures him. And in Jesus' own time, there were plenty of folks who would have said he got what he deserved. But no one would say that today. Not even people who don't follow him. So I'm not going to give away the power of Job's story if I tell you how it ends. It's already there. It's not something that hasn't been written. God hears Job's cry, and he acts restoratively in his life. It's not a happily ever after ending. But he ends up in a lot better place than he is at the end of chapter 1 and chapter 2. Likewise, when Jesus cries out to his Father, he's not... That was timely.
Help me, Dad, I'm being held captive in church.
He's not spared death on the cross. But that's not the end of the story. God raises him bodily. And that, friends, is not a parable. It is the most important event that has ever happened in history. It opens up life beyond human imagining. Now, when we cry out to God today, it would be way, way too soon and way, way too presumptuous on my part to begin to tell you what that restorative work will look like. But it will have something of the character of all citizens, whatever side of the law enforcement line they're on, whatever color they are, being able to live lives of flourishing and safety in our own land. And it will have something of the character of our not pulling apart from each other, but of our moving toward each other. That is a godly move. God always, always, always moves toward his people. So it would be too soon to know what that might look like, but it's not too soon for us to cry out in prayer. And it's definitely not too soon for us to move toward each other in this place, in our nation, and in our world. For the love of God, please, be about this. Amen.